Good evening, everybody. The November 21st general purpose meeting of the Castro Valley Municipal Advisory Council is in session. And I would ask Councilmember Podro to lead us in the pledge, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I pledge of allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, can we have the roll call, please?
Vice Chair Carbone.
Here.
Councilmember Kilbrew.
Present.
Councilmember Moore.
Here.
Councilmember Podro.
Present.
Councilmember Thomas.
Here.
Councilmember Prokopov.
Here.
Chair Mulgrew.
Present.
We have quorum.
Thank you so much. Moving on to item four in the agenda, public comments. Members of the community are invited to speak for up to 3 minutes on any subject or topic that is not on tonight's agenda. If you wish to speak on anything that's not on tonight's agenda, please use the raise hand button at the bottom of your screen and you will be called on by our clerk in order. Does anybody wish to make a comment? I see no hands raised. Very good. So we'll close the public comment portion of this meeting and we will move on to agenda item five, which is the approval of the minutes from the September 19th, 2022 meeting. Does anyone have anything to add, delete, or alter? If not, I'll take a motion.
I'll move. Second.
Madam Clerk, roll call.
Vice Chair Carbone.
Yes.
Councilmember Kilbrew.
Yes.
Councilmember Moore.
Yes.
Councilmember Podro.
Aye.
Councilmember Thomas.
Yes.
Councilmember Prokopov.
Yes.
Chair Mulgrew.
Aye. That sounded unanimous. All right, we're on to item number six, which is an informational item, COVID-19 and other communicable disease update. And tonight's presenter, I believe, is Kimmy Watkins-Tart, the director of the Healthcare Services Agency. Is Kimmy here?
I'm right here.
There you are. Floor is yours.
Thank you. Good evening. Council members, I haven't been to see you all in quite some time, and so I appreciate being given the opportunity to come before you and share information about what is going on around COVID and what we see moving forward. A slight correction, Colleen Chavla is the Healthcare Services Agency Director for Alameda County. I'm the Public Health Director. I think someone is going to bring up my slides.
Yes, hold on 1 second, Kimmy.
Thank you. All righty. Next slide, please. Next, sorry. Okay. So where we are right now is that our cases are about 10.9. Per 100,000 residents per day. Test positivity is ticking up a bit and it's at 6.3%. On average, we get around 3,200 PCR lab tests per day. And there are 86 people hospitalized with 8 in the ICU. During the year of 2022, we've had 495 COVID deaths. We are still considered in the CDC low community level, but we are seeing increases in our numbers. Next slide. These next few slides are just graphs that show visually what I just shared with you. So this first graph really is of our cases and the daily reported case rate. reached its low point in and around mid-October, and it has increased slightly since then. Next slide. Test positivity, the same, is also trending upwards over the past few weeks in the county overall, which is in blue. And you also see the numbers going up, with test positivity going up in those more disadvantaged neighborhoods in our county, and that's depicted in yellow. Next slide. This is a graph of our hospitalizations. Similarly, these are slightly up from their low point also in October. This is likely a mix of incidental COVID in people hospitalized for health issues other than COVID, as well as those who are hospitalized for severe disease. Next slide. This is a slide that shows the wastewater surveillance that we have been using more and more as time goes on. And it is really proving to be a pretty good picture of what is going on in terms of COVID positivity without the testing part of that. So our wastewater data also shows increased COVID circulation, and it remains to be seen whether this, of course, is a blip or it's the start of what we now know as a winter wave. Next slide. This is a snapshot from our dashboard, and what it shows here is booster uptake in our county. And so on the left side, you see that 58.7% of people have gotten their second boosters. Majority of people who have taken advantage of both boosters are 50 and older. On the right-hand side, you see the same, but this is by race, ethnicity. The Asian and white community have much higher booster uptake at 68.5 and 59.7. We are still working a lot with our Latinx and African American populations and Pacific Islanders whose booster uptake is still below the 50% mark. Next slide. This is information regarding our bivalent and boosters. And the last two bullets, I have to apologize, are not accurate. Essentially, there is a new booster available for all of us. Anyone above the age of 5 has access to a new bivalent booster. 5-year-olds, there is only the Pfizer booster, bivalent booster, but for 6-year-olds and over, you can get the a choice between the Pfizer or the Moderna. There is no booster or bivalent booster authorized yet for 6 months to 4-year-olds at this time. Next slide. This shows our booster uptake. It has been slow, a little bit slower than we would want. We're at 19.2%, and we really would like to see everyone vaccinated and boosted. And so we're still working toward a much higher goal than 19.2. Next slide. These next few slides are some highlights of what is going on in Castro Valley, or what has gone on in Castro Valley. So the top portion shows cases and deaths due to COVID. And so cumulative cases are 12,701. in Castro Valley, cumulative deaths are 80. Below is a picture of how vaccination has gone on in Castro Valley. And overall, those residents who have Castro Valley addresses, and that's what we go by, are boosted at a level of 87.9% fully vaccinated in Castro Valley. And the boosters are lower than we would like, as is the case for the overall population. But that second booster is only at 18.8%. And so we would like to see that up a little bit more. Next slide. There are a few planned activities happening in the next few weeks all over the county. But in particular, there's an event happening on December 4th at Castro Valley High School. We are partnering with Castro Valley Helping Hands, and one of our vaccine partners, BayPLS, will be there providing vaccinations alongside other activities for this event, food trucks, book fair, free giveaways and activities. And this, again, is at Castro Valley High School. This next highlight case investigations just gives you a bit of a summary of some of the activity that we've had related to contacts with people who have listed Castro Valley addresses. Right now in our COVID operation, we are not contacting everyone who tests positive for COVID or investigating all cases. But if we feel that the person is older or they have some higher risk, we are reaching out to people to encourage them to seek treatment, educating them about how to work with their doctor to see if they are eligible for COVID treatment, and helping them find a place to get treatment if they don't have a regular provider. Next slide. These next few slides, again, highlight just what's going on in Castro Valley specifically by age group. So the this first is a percentage with at least one dose by age for 5 to 11-year-olds, and this is at 79.1%. Next slide. Twelve to 17-year-olds are 84.9% with at least one dose. Next slide. And this is the 5+ are 97.6% with at least one dose. Next slide. As mentioned earlier, we are expecting, and you've been hearing this in the news, that we are expecting numbers to tick up and another fall and winter COVID wave may be already starting. There's additional hospital strain due to RSV as well as influenza. And all these things are circulating. These three are circulating simultaneously right now. The national emergency and public health emergency remains in effect. The state emergency declaration remains in effect until February 28th of 2023. Our local Alameda County health emergency remains in effect now. We do intend to align with the state framework and we'll assess COVID-19 transmission and severity into and through the winter. Next slide. I wanted to share a little about some other communicable diseases that we have been monitoring recently. Next slide. And so this is a slide that is showing influenza-like illness. And what we see here is the different colors for different ages. And so overall, what this is really showing us is that it's what we all know. This is cold and flu season is starting. And so influenza-like illness is going up everywhere. Next slide. Next slide. And so these next two slides, I believe, really show what has happened across the country in terms of in October and early November related to flu. Around right before Halloween, California was in the moderate for influenza activity. A lot of the country was still minimal flu activity. Only a few states, Texas and South and the East, Southeast, had higher levels. Next slide. But by the 5th, the picture changes pretty rapidly. California now has moderate to high levels of activity. And it has changed as well for many of the states across the country. So we are definitely in flu season. Next slide. This is just showing what it looked like inside of our state and where a lot of the burden was at that time. It was mostly in the southern region. Next slide. Again, this is more on these were hospitalizations, and it might be a little hard to see here, but the lavender colored line is the Bay Area and shows flu hospitalizations in the Bay Area. The highest really is for Southern California in that darker blue, and we're further behind, but still quite a bit ahead of the other parts of the state in terms of flu hospitalizations. Next slide. This slide is now showing the trends in RSV. And this slide, I mean, it's shot up really fast and pretty steep. You can see here, these colors are harder to distinguish, but the Bay Area is in that kind of gold color. It's like the third trend line down from the top, like in the middle. That's us. The green is upper Southern California area. And then I think the top is lower Southern California. So those top two are really from SoCal, and then we're behind them in that gold area for RSV. Next slide. So what can residents do? We can do a lot to protect ourselves and our loved ones from all the things that are circulating right now. Stay home when we're sick, stay up to date on our COVID-19 and flu vaccinations. Keep gatherings as small if we can, outside if possible. Right now, the weather's cold, but the weather's been beautiful. Or have gatherings in well-ventilated areas. Wear masks, that's always helpful. Test for COVID and have a plan to get treatment when needed. And I wanna say a point about the having a plan to get treatment. We have heard from people everywhere that it's been difficult at times for people to access treatment from their providers if they test positive and they call and they want to get therapeutics. And so one of the things getting better, more and more providers are getting into the flow of helping their patients get access to the treatment, but it's very time sensitive. And so what we're asking and really encouraging people to do is if you're able to reach out to your provider ahead of time, ask them, are you appropriate? Are you a good candidate for treatment? Most people are. There are a few of us who would not maybe be candidates, but it really could cut down on trying to chase down your provider to find out if you are a good candidate for treatment when you're not feeling well and you really need to get the treatment pretty fast. So again, if you're able to email, you know, your medical provider, set up a phone appointment just to find out whether or not they would recommend treatment for you and how you would get it. If you did test positive, doing that in advance is highly advisable. Next slide. Just a little information about avian flu. Avian flu has been detected in some birds in the Bay Area, Alameda County. We advise the public to avoid handling any dead birds that you see, of course, protecting any backyard birds and domestic flocks you may have from contact with wild birds. If you find a dead bird, please contact our vector control or the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Next slide. Next slide. I wanted to share a little information in these next two slides around MPOX and how that all how it all went. And I say how it all went because as of, I think, on the 13th, we essentially moved our MPOX response from an emergency response to back to our normal public health response. And so this graph here shows the curve of what happened. And essentially, we started getting cases in June, and they just really ticked up June, 4th of July, the summer, you know. And then they started to go down, and they have gone down consistently. And so at this point, we did not feel that we needed to have the large incident command structure set up that we had initially, in, which enables us to move quickly and to respond and to outbreaks. And we have transitioned our MPOX response activity to our normal public health programs at this time. And we had phenomenal community partners that really helped us to get people tested and vaccinated and educated around MPOX. We are continuing to educate people around this and want to remain vigilant, but we have stood down our emergency response around MPOX. Next slide. Sorry, next slide. Next slide. And I think these next few slides are just really kind of summarizing some of the things that we talked about earlier, just to let you know the things that we're doing in the community to help community residents, help community organizations. We're still distributing PPE through community-based organizations, distributing home test kits. Things are still free right now, testing and vaccines and therapeutics. And so we're really encouraging people to take advantage of that. Treatment and education and outreach to residents who are 50 and over, we're continuing to do that. Again, we are seeing that people are still very unclear about whether or not they qualify for treatment and are uncertain how to access it. And so we're trying to reach out to people, who, even if they don't call us, to make sure that they have the information that they need. Next slide. And this is just a sampling of our testing operation. We are continuing with our community testing in Alameda County. You can go to our website to get information about where testing sites are going to be. We are mostly doing pop-up home-based or mobile testing, mobile testing at this time, as well as for vaccines as well. And that'll be on the next slide. Here's a calendar of what we have going on, and this is available on our website in terms of our vaccine sites. Most, if not all, I believe, of our stationary vaccine pods are closed now. We're only doing mobile and pop-up vaccine operation with community partners upon request. And this next slide, I think, is more about therapeutics. This is also on our website. You can get information about how to call to get information if you don't have a doctor, if you don't have insurance, if you're unclear on how to access therapeutics. But again, we really would like for people to figure out what their plan is going to be before they test positive for COVID, before they go into gatherings and possibly, you know, get infected. Know beforehand. It will make the process of accessing treatment a lot smoother. And last, this is the last segment. Next slide. Next, go ahead. These are just some of the graphics that we have been putting up and have available on our social media and different places, trying to really educate people around seeking treatment, around prevention, how to protect themselves. And you can just flip through the these next couple of slides, Tona. Keep going. And this last bit right here, just wanted to share with you that along with community-based organizations and other stakeholders throughout the county that we've been working with this whole time, we have refreshed our COVID kind of strategy, like moving forward in terms of the public health department and how we plan to be organizing our resources and our work and our efforts and what we'll be focusing on. And so we do expect that more policies will be rolled back. And I shared a bit about that earlier on. We also expect that infections will rise. They are starting to rise already. And we are mostly concerned those who are greatest risk for severe disease are those who are unvaccinated and unboosted and are older. The challenge for us is to support the most impacted residents through this transition that we're having. Next slide. On our website, you can find our new COVID strategy and what we'll be focused on moving forward, making sure that those communities that have experienced the heaviest burden from COVID have the information and resources that they need will still be a focus of our work moving forward. We will be ramping up and have already begun to ramp up our outreach and education to educate people about how to protect themselves, how to protect their families. We are really narrowing in our outbreak investigation activities, focusing on complex cases, treatment, and those kinds of things. We provide a lot of technical assistance to facilities and businesses, answering questions, and those kinds of things. Next slide. And this is different than the direct outbreak management that we were involved in the first two years or so. All of our vaccine efforts at this point are very focused, targeted, mobile, pop-up, working with partners. Testing efforts are really linking people to treatment right away. If they test positive, trying to make sure that we get test kits in people's hands and masks in people's hands, so they have everything that they need to protect themselves and their family. We are continuing to work with the health system to increase access to all these things, and that will continue. Next slide. The things that we have discontinued and many of these things, some of these things you may be aware of, and some of these things really happened in the background and no one saw. But the universal case investigation and contact tracing, there was a time when we were calling everybody and investigating every single solitary case and trying to contact every person that a person had contact with. And we are no longer doing that. We also had about 10, 8 or 10 contracts with community-based organizations that we trained that helped us with the case and contact investigation. That partnership was phenomenal. It really helped us reach people, people who would not have answered the phone if we had been the ones calling. And it helped us just to reach more people because there were more of us out there. You all probably remember those mass vaccination sites. Those are long gone, as are the stationary pods that we had throughout the county. Again, our vaccine work is really focused on pop-ups, mobile, and this is done in partnership with community organizations upon request, like the event happening on the 4th of December at Castro Valley High. That's the pop-up, and that's what we're doing now. And these last two are things that are happening in the background that most people don't see, but just a lot of the manual kind of activity, data analysis and handling of the database with the state that was going on in the past that requires a lot of people. All of those things have been discontinued and dialed way back. Next slide. And last, just want to leave you with ways to stay informed about what we're doing, both with COVID as well as other health activities. We have a COVID community advisory group. That group meets the second Tuesday of every month from 5:30 to 7. Then next, we just had our last meeting, so our next meeting will be in December. Our public health department has a public health commission, and the commission meets on the second Thursday of the month from 6 to 8. That conversation, of course, that commission focuses on much broader issues, not just COVID. I am there to provide a director's update and have always provided some information on COVID, and it depend on what was happening at the time. And last but not least, our healthcare services agency has COVID-19 updates. And you can go to our website to get information about how you may participate in those webinars to get COVID updates. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Director Watkins-Tart. That was a heck of a lot of information, all good information, and very well presented, much appreciated. I think tonight we'll start with public comment on the item. So if anyone in the audience wishes to speak or has questions, please use the raise hand button at the bottom of the screen, and Madam Clerk will call on you. You'll have 3 minutes to speak, and after the public comments, then we'll hear questions and comments from the council. Anybody in the audience wish to speak on this or ask questions? I see
we
none.
We do not see enough speakers.
Thank you so much. All right. We will close public comment on this, and we'll start off the council comments with Vice Chair Carboni.
Yeah. Thank you, sir. Thank you for that presentation. And I do have a question, and let's go back. You had a slide there where, you know, it showed the death rate and everything in Castro Valley. But, you know, I'd really be interested in knowing what the average age of the person that actually passed away was, and not just a number, to give us a better idea on what's really going on, because you're saying the ones at risk, but just curious what that is.
I can get that information for you, but what I can say overall for deaths, you know, the heaviest burden really hit, you know, our older population. But I can find out for you in terms of the ages.
Yeah, because I've seen in other areas, you know, you've got people in their 80s and 90s, and there's obviously a lot of other health concerns too that are.
That's correct.
There, and I'm curious because I'd like to compare that with the vaccinated and the general population. And, you know, instead of creating this statement of over concern about being so risky. You know, I'm still watching people that are completely healthy, you know, scared to take off a mask. I think it's unfortunate. So that's why I'm interested in those numbers. Mm-hmm. Okay. But anyway, that's the only question I have. Thank you.
Yeah. Council Member Moore.
Thank you for the opportunity and great presentation. Thank you for that. I had a couple of questions as I was watching in the slides. Is first off, how do we compare to 2018 prior to COVID with the flu and influenza? Because we're looking at recent information and I have nothing, no bar to set it against, whether we're better or worse or anything like that. And I'm a little concerned about the disadvantaged neighborhoods and what's going on there that we need to do differently. Because I think there's been an awful lot of effort from your department for everyone in all neighborhoods. And then I was wondering, do you have any data on any of the side effects from people that have had COVID or had the shot? Or side effects from the shot. And anyway, so I'm just concerned about that. And then I've had COVID when it was early on and it kicked my butt. And then I had it a couple months ago and it was like having the sniffles and the flu. And I've had 5 friends lately that I've had tested positive for COVID in their tests, but it was like, no big deal. I got the sniffles and the flu. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at these COVID numbers, sometimes they look pretty alarming, but it seems like it's died off from a standpoint of potency or whatever you want to call it, because this last time I had it, it was, you know, 3 days later, I was ready to go again, mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. So I just wonder, do you have any data on that? Is it less effective or something, or, you know? So anyway, but thank you for the presentation. It was very enlightening.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. Director, Council Member Kilroo, please.
Hi, thank you for the presentation. I just had a question for the pop-up on December 4th. Is it open to the community at large, or is it primarily for Castor Valley Unified families?
I will find out.
Okay. And then the follow-up question to that would be, are they disseminating this information and how, through what channels, so that people are aware of this opportunity? That's it, thank you.
Okay.
Good. Sorry, go ahead, please. Councilmember Prokopov.
Thank you, sir. And thank you, Ms. Watkins-Tuck, for the presentation. I had a question about the case rates and not just the data that you shared tonight, but I've always wondered, my understanding is that those are reported positive tests. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is there how aligned are those rates to kind of projections you have of, you know, all the folks who are walking around who may not know them, that they're ill or that have, you know, tested at home and not reported that or anything like that? Is there a different set of data that you use for those things, or are they quite aligned?
We do not have data for anyone who's walking around who has not tested. The best data that we have now is the wastewater surveillance data. And so that's why I commented on that, that it's not dependent upon people getting tested. And so far, it is allowing us to see when there's more COVID circulating in the community, when there's less, without people having to test and that sort of thing. Our numbers are only based on the tests that we get. And so that is a fraction. Everyone doesn't test, first off. a lot of people to the point. I think Councilmember Moore, I think you mentioned this point, that a lot of people aren't going to test if you have the sniffles. A lot of people, you know, and especially now because it's cold and flu and there's so much other stuff out there, a lot of people aren't even going to test. If they don't feel bad, if they just kind of feel like, okay, just kind of a little runny nose, and they might not even bother testing. So we are definitely not seeing everything. And so that's one of the reasons why we really try to promote the general precautions of, if you're sick, try to stay home, you know, stay away from other people because you don't really know, you know, and while you might be fine, the other person may have underlying health conditions and they might not fare so well, you know, kind of thing. And so that's really what we're trying to encourage. But no, you're absolutely correct. The numbers that we have, and I don't have any projections of how many cases we think are probably out there, because I think that's what you're asking. That may be available somewhere. I don't have that number though, but what we have is a fraction.
Thank you.
Councilmember Thomas.
Good evening. Thank you for the presentation. It was a lot of information, but quick question on the side effects. I think Councilmember Moore talked about it, the side effects of the COVID booster. You know, I haven't taken my second booster, but there's notions out there that there are serious side effects from coming from these boosters. And I don't know if that is true or not, but with the concern that I have and the people telling me, a lot of my friends haven't taken, is there a side effects? Is that a serious? That's my first question. My second question is, what is the difference on symptoms on RSV and COVID? Is there a big difference or is it the same symptoms? That's all.
So let me answer some of this information I will definitely need to get back to you all with. Some of it I can answer though. So my understanding though, in terms of RSV, is that I think that it doesn't have the flu-like feeling, like the fever. It may not have all those aspects of it, but you still have the runny nose, the coughing, that part of it. I believe I can find out from our physicians, the symptom list in terms of exactly how different they are. But again, there are a lot of people who test positive for COVID who don't have a fever, who don't get the body aches, who may only have the sniffles. And so then for those individuals, it might not be distinguishable, quite honestly. It really may not be. The other question you asked is about, and I can find, you know, I can take a look at some more of the, ask our clinical team around some more recent research and some data around side effects. There are immediate, many people have, you know, some impacts from the shot, the booster, you know, that kind of thing. Long-term side effects, that's very minimal in terms of the vaccines themselves. I mean, it's really, 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 really small, not a ton, but I can get information for you on that. But yeah, I mean, most people do feel the COVID vaccine. I mean, I felt all of them except the first one that I didn't feel too much.
You get that 12-hour, after 12 hours, you get that pain.
The second one, the booster, I felt everything. Yeah. And so, you know, and I have to plan, you know, to be off work and plan to kind of be laid out a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
And then I'm fine, you know, after that.
Got it.
So, there was another question that I think I might be able to answer. We are tracking long COVID. I think it was Councilmember Moore asked also about long COVID. That it's a real thing. Long COVID is very real. We are seeing people, whether you had mild symptoms, no symptoms, or severe illness, there's now data showing that you can be affected by having had it long term. And so I can send back some of the research that we're looking at and that we're seeing. There are active studies going on in California to track people who have had COVID and to ask them questions about their symptoms after the fact, you know, that kind of thing, because that's how a lot of this is being done, to talk to people who have had COVID and follow them and to see how they're feeling. So there are still benefits to try to prevent getting COVID. If, especially since it doesn't mean, it is not contingent upon having severe illness. So there was a time, I think, where a lot of us thought, okay, well, the people who might have long COVID are the folks who maybe have severe illness. And then we learned, no, not necessarily. You could have a mild case. And so it's still, you know, it's beneficial for us to try not to get it. You know, we might not be able to prevent getting it, but it's still advantageous to try.
You good, Tojo?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you. I just have a couple of questions, Director Watkins, start if you can bear with me for a second. On slide 16, it says we intend to align with the state timeframe as local conditions allow. My understanding is the state state of emergency for the state ends on February 28th.
Yes.
What are the metrics that have to be met for it to stay ended, the state of emergency, that is?
I don't know that I understand your question. Did that
we get to February 28th and the state of California says, oops, state of emergency is ended. And that's, I guess the question is that regardless of the case rate, mortality, are there any metrics attached to that?
Mm-hmm. You know, let me check the secretary's press conference, because I think he did speak to that, Dr. Galley. But I believe that the state of emergency will end February 28th. And I believe that, and I will check to see what they actually said. But unless something pretty significant happens, I mean, really significant, I do think, I'm not the governor. I can't, you know what the governor is planning, but mm-hmm. I believe it's going to end February 28th.
Thank you. And then the qualifier on that, as local conditions allow, what would be the local conditions that would prohibit the state of emergency, the county's state of emergency to end?
I don't want to presume to think, you know, and, you know, be inside of Dr. Moss's head. However, again, something really significant, like there are no hospital beds, complete crashing of our system. I don't know, you know, we have to kind of wait till we get there, but our plan is to align with the state. And we are assuming that we will not have anything totally different, you know, in our county. I mean, we don't want to ever say never.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah, I understand. I appreciate that. Any other thoughts or comments from the council?
Someone asked. Someone asked me a question about what's going on in more disadvantaged communities, that we're doing a lot. What's happening? And so there are a lot of factors that are making COVID, that are causing, there are a lot of factors contributing to how COVID has landed in certain communities. Working conditions is one of them. For those of us who, you know, were able to work remotely and go home with our computers and laptops and hole up in our house, and, you know, we could protect ourselves, you know, and for many people, they can't do that. Many people also have multiple jobs. And so they're not just at one location, even if that one location is crowded, they might be in multiple locations because they have two jobs, three jobs, that kind of thing. So there's multiple exposures that they have to large numbers of people. And so that's going to put them more at risk. We also have larger numbers of families in overcrowded housing situations and living situations. And so their ability to isolate and to, you know, not infect everyone in the house is really compromised when one person gets COVID and it just spreads through the household. And so housing, working conditions, also not having paid leave, that's a big deal. If you can't take off of work to stay home, to not infect other people, then you're not going to stay home. You're going to go to work. And that's what a lot of people have done. That's what a lot of people still do. And so those are the kinds of things that they existed before COVID. And so we all heard people talk about COVID revealing these, you know, things that were happening under the surface already. That's an example of what COVID revealed. Those things were already there.
Thank you so much. Councilmember Padro has a hand up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director, for your presentation. The one thing I was curious about in your presentation this evening when we were talking about prevention is early onset really dictated a lot of emphasis on washing of one's hands. And yet that was not included in your report at all. Has that been kind of poo-pooed now, or is that still equally as important as masking?
Washing your hands is always a good thing, sir. And
trust me, I know that, but I see a lot of folks who don't do that. That's why I asked the question.
No, I totally understand. So in the beginning, we weren't really sure if it was airborne, whether it was on surfaces, that kind of thing. And so we're like, okay, wash your hands. And we weren't sure. We learned that it was airborne. And so for COVID, masking is more protective, but for RSV, the hand washing. So if I didn't have that on the slide, I have to fix that right away, because there are other things that are more, that are surface, that are transmitted by surface, RSV being one of those things.
Exactly. It was
conspicuous
by its absence. It was really conspicuous by its absence. Yeah.
Yes, I have to correct that right away.
Thank you very much.
Director Watkins-Tarr, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for all the great work done by your organization in keeping our community members safe. And Godspeed, and I hope the next time we see you, it won't be under a state of emergency.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. Cheers.
Thank you.
All right. Our next agenda item is also informational, and it's an update on the Water Course Protection Ordinance, a modification, pardon me. I see Daniel. Will you be presenting tonight, Daniel?
Yes, I will be. Can you hear me?
Perfectly.
All right, let me share my screen. Hopefully everybody has received share. There it goes. Okay. So this is a very brief, but most likely a very timely update of the Water Course Protection Ordinance. And just for clarification, the Chapter 13.2 defines, identify the purpose of the WPO as written here, is enacted to safeguard and preserve water course, protect lives and property, prevent damage due to flooding, protect drainage facilities, and so on. So everybody knows, we have water courses and creeks throughout Alameda County that we all cherish. And the purpose of this ordinance is to protect the water courses. Now, this is, like I said, a very highly focused, narrow focused update. The key element of this update is to designate a new unincorporated area county stream map, introduce Article 7, which is an administrative enforcement procedure that's entirely added to this ordinance, and very, very minor language definitions, clarifying setbacks and introducing a setback diagram incorporated in our website, as well as defining floodways and floodplain. Now, why do we need a new street map? So currently the WPO identifies streams based on the USGS, the current USGS map, 7.5 minute series, usually called the blue line streams. This has been in the ordinance. Basically, creeks are identified by the US, the latest USGS 7.5 minute series map. Until the most recent USGS map revision, the blue line streams remained unchanged for several decades. However, in 2018, and also the current 2021 USGS map eliminated previously designated blue line streams that could, in our judgment, potentially be considered perennial or intermittent creeks. And I'll show you down the line what I meant by those. During summer field inspection at some selected location, that were eliminated in the recent revision, we found and saw some running water observed in May, indicating that potentially these could be a live stream type of water courses. Most importantly, as you know, most of these streams are natural phenomena, naturally existing items, and they don't necessarily kind of emerge out of nowhere. And I don't know why we have to revise them year over year on a regular basis. So a stream is a stream. Once it's there, created, stays there. So one of the reasons that we wanted to make sure is just depending on this changing US geological map, it's kind of making the ordinance very unpredictable. So we wanted to make sure we have established regularly non-substantially changing topographic map for implementation of the WPO. Now, here is a good example of to show you what the 2015 versus the current 2021 map looks like. The one that you see in red are the ones that were both red and green were present in the 2015 map. Everything that you see on this map were present in 2015 map. However, in 2021 map or the 2018-21 map, the red ones disappeared and only the green lines were shown. So as you can see, there's a substantial difference between the 2015 map that has been in place for years versus the 2018 and 2021 maps. So this is just to give you a visual comparison of what the changes were. So what did we do? We went out and started looking at, let's look at some of these creeks that were eliminated in the 2021 or 2018 map. And here's one, Ward Creek tributary. We went out there on May 3rd, and the map shows you the location where this photo was taken. As you can see, on May 3rd, there was clearly some running water in Ward Creek. That's location one. And location two was Sulphur Creek. As you can see on the map, you can see where Sulphur Creek is and where this picture was taken. And on May 3rd, there were some running water along Sulphur Creek in this area. Another location we want to look at was along Castro Valley Creek and as well as the Kelly, upper Castro Valley and Kelly Canyon Creek. We didn't find any running water, for example, in the upper Castro Valley Creek, but down at the Kelly Creek, you can see in the picture that there was some running water on May 3rd that was observed. So remember, the ones that we're looking at are the area that were removed from the 2021 or the 2018 map. They used to be part of the Blue Line Creek in 2015 and prior to that. Here's another good one, which was a surprise to me because we have looked at Stony Brook for other conditions before in terms of studying even fish passage along this creek. And this creek was eliminated in the 2018-21 map. And clearly there is running water when we went out there on May 3rd, 2022, to see if there was any water in this creek, and there was. So this is just to give you an idea, the creeks that were removed in the 2018-2021 but they were in place as a Blue Line Creek prior to 215 and beyond in the past. So that's just, these are the four locations just to give you a snapshot of these things. So what is the unincorporated Alameda County stream map? The map basically adopted from the 2015 USGS topographic map or the Blue Line maps that were in place for, like I said, for several decades until the change in 2018. It will be used to determine streams that are subject to the provisions of the Alameda County Water Course Protection Ordinance. And they will, you know, will no longer be using USGS topographic map as a reference to manage the WPO. The unincorporated county stream map will be available electronically at the flood control website. It could also be overlaid on Google Earth by using KMZ files that we will be putting in the website that people can use, and I can share some of that stuff with you today. Hard copies will be available at the County Permit Center. And basically, how-to instructions, it's not required as part of this update, but we wanted to make sure that we have a frequently asked question type of section added into this update. Now, this is what the map looks like. The Alameda County Unincorporated map look like. This is the northern portion. As you can see, the tan color is the unincorporated area. And the blow up, you can see in the past, the dotted blue lines used to be the ones that were eliminated. Now they're restored back to what they used to be prior 2015 or prior. This is the east portion. Like I said, the tan portion is the one that you can see in the unincorporated area. This map is strictly for the unincorporated area only. So the ordinance does not apply to the cities. And here is the southern portion. As you can see, there is a substantial amount of creeks and tributaries within the county. So the blue lines show you the creeks and the tributaries associated in this area that are subject to the WPO. Now, these can be seen, like I said, on Google Earth. And I think the reason we like to incorporate this is because you can zoom in and out to see using Google Earth what type of creek it is and all that stuff and the specific location and overlaid on the actual, is there any development, is it a natural ravine, or all those things will be visible when you look at it in the Google Map format. And here is what it looks like. The blue lines, as you can see, are all the creeks that are in that area. As you zoom in, you can see the blue lines, and you could also see the topography features, whether there are vegetations, whether they're development and all those things. I actually will, I'll do a live demonstration of the Google Earth to you so that you can actually see how this thing is of added value. And I think this is an excellent way to kind of inform people, especially those, you know, want to see, right, you know, narrow down to their specific property using Google Earth. Now, this is the proposed changes. And like I said, it's extremely, extremely minor changes that were proposed. In this case, you can see with strikeout where it says blue line, most recent USGS survey, 7.5 minute topography maps. We replaced that one with the unincorporated Alameda County stream map. So that's basically fundamentally switching the USGS map to this map so that we have a fixed location for these things that we can actually be talking year over year rather than changing or subject to change to USGS updates. And then the abatement provision. In the past, the agency used Chapter 15.28 to do these abatements. And we learned recently that it's very difficult to hire hearing officers from outside. And we tried one time, I tried to work with the state to get any administrative hearing officers. After trying for 6 months, they finally ignored me, so I gave up. So that kind of gave us an idea, what should we do? And that kind of bring the issue back to our discussion. And we said, why not use an existing body of community members, which are the East and West County BZAs, to become a public hearing body that can hear the abatement appeals. And if people disagree with the BZA, they can also go to the board eventually. So that's all this thing is. And most people prefer to have the BZA use this mechanism anyway. So I don't see it to be a major shift in standard practice. Now, these are the other things that we added into the setback criteria. Here's the drawing of what a setback will be. It will be basically by definition 20 feet from top of bank. There used to be about three different drawings associated with that. One was basically subject to the floodplain ordinance, the floodplain management regulation under chapter 1508, which is under the building code. So there was no real reason to have that drawing within the WPO because it really is subject to floodplain regulations. So we took those out and we clearly defined, stayed focused on the WPO, what a workhorse setback should be. The other one is obviously the floodplain management, generally under 15.4, that is also tied to the FEMA, floodplain management requirements, flood insurance and all those things. Those things are captured under the 15.4, that's the floodplain management. So the second, the third drawing you might want to say was removed because there was really, it was really more confusing, the WPO rather than anything else, because at the end of the day, fundamentally the water course setback is 20 feet from the top of bank. And if you can't locate the top of bank, as you can see that the 2-to-1 slope that can go from the bottom until you hit the horizontal, close to horizontal of the bank and 20 feet from there. So it really captures all the scenarios that you can imagine when it comes to setback and development associated within or outside the setback. And obviously we wanted to make sure we define floodplain and floodway, and we want to make them standard with FEMA floodplain and floodway definitions. And these definitions are right now consistent with standard FEMA other floodplain management definitions of what a floodplain is and a floodway is. So this is basically the minor revision that I talked about that we added. So then we went ahead and developed a series of frequently asked questions. And these are basically to assist the general public from jumping in and reading a whole ordinance. They might just focus on what's the purpose if they want to know, when do I need a water course ordinance permit from the county? And how do I know if my property is in the, regulated by WPO? Those are the kind of fundamentally a user-friendly question that kind of gives them a brief response immediately rather than going and searching into a multi-page ordinance to find the information. So we have a series of these things, and you can read them at your leisure. I think we have a few of those things highlighted, in the it says, for example, is WO permit the only requirement to work with along with a water course street? So within the ordinance, we don't want to define the various organizations. We kind of captured them as federal, state, and local governments. But here in the WPO, we have, frequently asked question, we even highlighted some of the potentially permitting organization that people will have to deal with when they do work within water course or the stream. And we provided a contact information at the end, and people could actually look at this, and hopefully we've addressed some of the questions that they might have. And as we get more questions from people and they seem to be relevant, we can add them and upgrade these frequently asked questions on a regular basis. So hopefully that gets us to a point where people will have an FAQ that they can quickly go to get their answers without actually having to call or deal with anybody else when they're looking for some information. So that kind of gives you an idea of what the update basically is. So I'm going to see if I can actually get to the behind this thing is, there it is. Here is, can you see it? The Google Earth?
No.
Yeah.
Now, hold on. I think I unshared. Somebody unshared it.
There it is.
There it is. So Google Earth, when you click that KMZ file, like I said, you get to the Google Earth portion. So it will automatically populate. And these are all the creeks within Alameda County. But, you know, somebody says, I want to really focus on, and let's see if we can find Castro Valley. There's Castro Valley right here. And, you know, let's say what this creek is. I can click on this creek. And it gives me information. It says the name is San Lorenzo Creek. It gives you all these various other information that are relevant for anybody who's doing hydrology or hydraulics work. And type of creek is major perennial creek. Alameda County creek name is Crow Creek. So you get enough information. But at the same time, one of the most important thing is you can see whether you're in a developed area or in the rural area, is there a topographic difference? And you'll find some of the creeks that are shown might appear as if there's no creek, but some of them are stop and start because of development or any other kind of scenario. So this is what the value of this is, because it really gives you the person applying a real focus to look at, hey, what's going on here? Let me see my property, and I'm right here. So, here I am. So what is this thing? And it might not have a name, by the way, because some of it, in this case, it's Ward Creek. So the county name is Ward Creek. It gives you that information. It also gives you several other stuff that you might find useful. But if you are, you own a property, you want to find out whether there's a creek there that's regulated or not, you can go out there and look at it. And this is a new addition that we have included in our presentation. So I think we believe this is a useful tool for future, for folks to be able to see a lot more than just using the static map, whether on paper or on the system here. So with that, I'm happy to answer any question you may have.
Thank you, Daniel. Much appreciate the great information, the quality presentation. I think we'll start again with the public comment on this item. So if members of the public wish to speak, please use the raise hand button at the bottom of the screen, and our clerk will call on you in order. You'll have 3 minutes to speak, and after the public comments and questions, we'll hear from our council. So, Madam Clerk,
Bruce, do we have you're on the line.
Hi, this is Bruce King with Friends of San Lorenzo Creek. I emailed some comments on this presentation to you yesterday. Hopefully, you've seen the comments. I will touch on some highlights. Thank you, Director Roald Decembet, for your work on this. We generally support the county's plan to define watercourses by adopting a county stream map that shows streams that were previously shown on the 2015 topo maps. Developing a new county stream map is the county's proposed solution. Although in March, we proposed what we think was a more straightforward solution using existing county maps and the existing 50-acre watershed criteria. Next, the county needs to recheck the proposed stream maps to ensure that all stream segments shown on the 2015 topo maps are also shown on the county stream map. Most of the streams have been transferred correctly, but my random map audits easily finds a few smaller stream segments still missing from the proposed county stream map, and locations of some stream segments not matching the exact locations. Next, the Q&As presented today are very important, need to be expanded and posted online. Needed additions to the Q&As, for example, are the Watercourse Protection Ordinance definitions for development and structures, and the WPO purposes of creek setbacks and criteria for a watercourse permit. Next, the WPO and county stream map does not cover many smaller streams, but these streams still have protections under state and federal jurisdiction. For example, natural streams are jurisdictional if the stream flows with sufficient energy to create a defined bed and bank of any size. So the county needs to better assure that project proponents identify locations and possible requirements for these streams. This has been an ongoing water board and fish and wildlife concern, and is a problem we routinely see in projects. We recommend adding this to the Q&As and a section in the ordinance. Next, the county proposed keeping one of the existing creek setback diagrams, eliminating two of the diagrams, and adding a new setback criterion statement. These proposals need public review, and diagrams need to be posted on the online ordinance. Lastly, we agree with the need to define a watercourse with a new stream map, but we are not necessarily in agreement with what the county's full proposed changes to the definition of watercourse. Changes in definition need explanation and public review. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.
Hi, Michelle, you're on the line. Michelle?
Hi, sorry about that. I just want to say that change isn't always bad, and maybe we do need this change, but the question is, how is this going too far? I believe that this ordinance was originally written to protect for 30 to 40 years. Since making this change to the ordinance could seize private property rights from people who own property next to these creeks, shouldn't we take the time to conduct these additional studies beyond just using Google, which is good, but maybe not thorough enough, and verify that these are indeed creeks under the criteria we are setting? Shouldn't we also notify the property owners whose property rights will be impacted? Given the time allowed, I'm sure the county has done their best to document the conditions in each place the day immediately after a significant rainfall, but wouldn't it make sense to have more than just a single data point before we start changing the rules? I believe the criteria is flowing water 10 days after a rain event. Do we have any long-term studies or data for these creeks using this criteria? I know several people who are building ADUs or want to build them on their lots that would be affected if this updated ordinance was adopted. Would making this update conflict with any of the recently enacted state ADU laws? Allowing this change without proper data, thorough research, and strong justification could put the county at risk. So although this may be the proper action, I believe more long-term studies should be completed to verify that each of these areas still qualify under the criteria the county already has in place prior to making any changes to the ordinance. Alternatively, maybe we should share this data once collected with the USGS and ask them for updates. All I'm saying is that making uninformed updates to ordinances could cause an adverse impact on property owners, and it shouldn't happen. I'm asking that we complete proper studies of each area before making any updates to the ordinance. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Hi, Roxanne, you're on the line.
Thank you. I'm Roxanne Lewis, and I want to make it clear that I'm speaking as a Castro Valley resident and not as a member of any border agency. I live at the headwaters of Castro Valley Creek, and in the past several years, people have built decks, put bridges, installed trampolines, undergrounded creeks for the purpose of parking their cars on their lots. So it looks to me like having this new ordinance will help with that. You know, all these creeks need to be protected, and by using the other map, it just wasn't working. I even had one public works inspector say to me, well, you know, these people can do whatever they want with their property, even if it's around creeks. So I think by having this update, it'll help a lot and protect all our creeks. Thank you.
Thank you, Roxanne.
Hi, Chuck, you're on the line.
Yes, first, my name is Chuck Meadows. And first of all, I wanted to commend you, Director Waldeson-Bett, for making the much needed improvement to the Water Course Protection Act. The issue I'd like to discuss is a great law is not very useful if it is not actually enforced. One of the things I noticed in your proposed fines is that the fine, the highest level of fine was only $500. Just to give you an idea of how insignificant that is to a violator, we're above the tributary in Ward Creek, that one of the photos that you showed was actually behind our house. The problem is the damage to our property from someone who chose to violate these laws is now currently estimated at $450,000 and growing. So a fine of $500 to a violator is next to nothing. It's like they can just pay the fine and move on. I think what we really need is that when a person has been found guilty, that the abatement and remediation rules be strong enough that there's a financial incentive to the party that is a no-brainer. If I only had to pay a $500 fine versus paying $450,000 to $500,000 remediation costs, I'll just pay the fine and walk away. What we need are fines that are stiff enough that the violator looks at it and says, well, if you're going to fine me $200,000, I guess I better fix this problem. And not leave it to private parties to have to go to the court system to enforce the law. So again, I commend you for making these much needed improvements. I do think that the enforcement side needs to be addressed more fully. I think pending violations and active enforcement actions should be posted on a public website so that we're aware of them. And we can go ahead and monitor the activity in terms of the enforcement. Also, I think there needs to be a mandatory 30-day reinspection period and each 30 days thereafter until the situation has been abated. I think there should be a distinction between commercial projects, because I understand that you have a significant number of commercial projects that you also have to supervise, versus residential properties, which are obviously at a smaller scale, but they also don't have the type of engineering and other expertise to do the projects properly. So I think that a 30-day post-inspection follow-up and a continuing 30-day follow-up should be imposed until the situation has been remedied. And I think there needs to be a strong enough enforcement mechanisms so that violators can't simply ignore the consequences of their violations. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Hi, Kelly, you're on the line.
Okay, thank you. So one of the commenters is raising fear, uncertainty, and doubt about any uninformed changes to this ordinance. Now, we already had wholesale radical change sponsored by the Public Works Agency. That happened in 2018 as they stood by and watched USGS maps. And then they go out and have been telling people that creeks don't exist if they're not on the map. So we already had that radical change. And this is this is just trying to undo the unprovoked and unthought through, the completely mindless change that happened in 2018. Now, as far as, but there's this fear that this might impact private property rights in urban areas like Castor Valley and Pleasanton. And of course, that fear is wholly founded, 100% correct fear. Take a look inside the city limits. You see how these maps that are being promulgated today are completely crazy and useless, where they put blue lines down the middle of houses underneath people's bedrooms. Take a look at Benedict Court in Pleasanton, Hines Ranch Court in Pleasanton, Arbor Drive near Vintage Hills Park in Pleasanton. These are all within the incorporated areas. But the Public Works Agency, their slides show that they went out and dug down to the bottom of Kelly Creek and Sulphur Creek. And they're implying that this map has been thoroughly inspected for ground truth. And they've looked at every inch of the creeks, you know, and taken pictures and measured the water flow. Of course, nothing could be farther than the truth. Take a look at Lake inside the unincorporated Alameda County, Lake A in Pleasant in Livermore, chain of lakes just downstream from Sycamore Grove Park. In 1993, they had a blue line wandering through there. Now they've dug out a lake. And that blue line is still, it runs through a lake up a cliff. Water doesn't flow uphill, guys. I went to school, studied science. I learned that water doesn't flow uphill. That blue line through Lake A of the chain of lakes is crazy. There's a blue line underneath a nuclear facility on Vallecitos Atomic Laboratory Road in Vallecitos Canyon. There's a Vallecitos channel out there, just south of the Mexican rodeo and just right next to the paintball business, that Vallecitos Channel lost a mile of channel east of the paintball business. 1 mile of creek is not on this map. And then underneath 680, a quarter mile east of 680, underneath 84, underneath a freeway, a blue line goes underneath the freeway. It's insane. So yeah, these maps are inaccurate and wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly.
Hi, Anne, you're on the line.
Hi, my name's Dr. Anne E. Maris. I'm a resident of Castro Valley and a biochemist educator. Thank you for restoring what county protections creeks could potentially have. I think this is not enough and the county needs to go further. I'm going to touch on two topics that are not included as a purpose of the ordinance, climate crisis and equity. I understand that the history of creeks here mainly involves taming them so that more human development can take place. We build dams, we put the water course in concrete channels, which prevent the normal fish species migrations. Types of fish called salmonids require fresh water to spawn, but live much of their lives out in the salt water. When we block their migration upstream, we remove a huge part of our healthy ecosystem. We can see in cases like at Alameda Creek down by Niles that when the fish barriers are overcome, the fish come back, and we see majestic bald eagles at the creek. All of our urban waterways are polluted. Dogs die from drinking our natural water. One, climate crisis. This is a great opportunity to incorporate the need to protect and restore our creeks for the purpose of responding to the climate crisis. We know that the most biodiversity of species exists at creeks, and we also know that humans have caused massive extinctions. Creeks need trees to stay cool for wildlife habitat. We need it too. Public health is directly related to pollution and overheating. Two, equity. This is also a great opportunity to incorporate racial and economic equity in the ordinance. The original sin, of course, was the genocide of the Ohlone tribes, whose lives center on the creek. Because water is life, Ohlone descendants should be included in determining what creek protections are necessary. The majority of San Lorenzo Creek is unincorporated county. It's the second largest creek discharging into the bay from the east. It's also the most polluted. The county has currently implemented California State Senate Bill SB 1000 and writing the required environmental justice element. How the creek is protected is important to SB 1000 neighborhoods, where residents already have worse health outcomes and less resources to stay healthy. Having a healthy creek is an important indicator of our local pollution. For example, when I was a kid, the creeks at Grove Way were full of frogs. Now there are none. Amphibians are the first to go because their skin is sensitive and permeable to pollutants. Please consider using this update of the Watercourse Protection Ordinance to include the purposes of addressing environmental justice and also the climate crisis. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Maris.
Hi, Matt, you're on the line.
Hey, good evening. You know, this goes back to my tenure on the MAC when we did a major review of the Watercourse Protection Ordinance many years ago. It's a welcome thing to revisit it. Going back even more historically, we had the specific plan for areas of environmental significance that was passed in 1977 for Alameda County. And in that, it required the county to go and map all of our creeks. This was never done, and this is still on the books. It'd be great to actually catch up with our past and some of the great documents that we have in the planning department and actually fulfill them. Going out and mapping all of our creeks and waterways, our intermittent streams, ephemeral streams, everything, so that we just have an inventory of it that is accurate, is a worthy investment. And I hope that that'll something that could come of this as we move forward with bringing back the you know, a fully implemented water course protection ordinance. And I really do want to echo the sentiments of some of the previous speakers, particularly Bruce King and Chuck Moore. And Chuck's focus on enforcement is something that's really critical. I mean, even, you know, the specific plan for areas of environmental significance and other documents that we have on the books, you know, some great language, but without, you know, the backing of enforcement and update, you know, it's just that. It's a nice document on a shelf gathering dust. So I hope we'll put some teeth into this and make sure that it is actually fully expanded and implemented. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
Hi, Michael, you're on the line.
I'm going to speak really quickly here. I just want to restore some sanity to like what we're hearing here. We're talking about fish, salmon coming up these creeks and bald eagles and stuff. You know, these pictures all were taken on the same day, and they were taken on the same day right after a heavy rain. Okay. I actually live across, you know, one of these so-called creeks, and that's standing water that you're looking at. Okay. In some cases, it's not running water. We're not talking about something that's going to create the Grand Canyon. We're talking about something that creates mosquitoes. Okay. So let's be realistic. I think we need a little bit more data on this. You know, we followed the USGS for, I heard someone say 30, 40 years, and that's what we've done up to this point. Now we don't like it. You know, it's like, I hear people, you know, complain about climate change, you know, the earth's getting hotter and we don't have enough water. And now we have so much water, we have to, you know, name creeks that have dried up because of climate change or creeks again. So I don't really understand the arguments that, you know, a lot of people are making here. But I just want to restore some sanity to this. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Do we have anybody else that wishes to share or ask on this particular subject? All right. Close the public discussion portion of this item, and we'll look to the council for thoughts and comments. Chuck, Councilmember Moore, quick hand.
Yeah, I hope we get the right Moore this time. I saw a Chuck M down on the corner of the screen, and it certainly wasn't me. Anyway, Daniel, thank you for the presentation. And an update. One of my concerns is if you go back and do a current mapping, I don't know how many of you have looked at Crow Creek, but there's hardly any, there isn't hardly any water in it. When it rains, you'll probably get water for 3 or 4 days, but it's not even a creek anymore. It is, somebody just mentioned the mosquito catcher, and that's probably what you have. You have a couple little areas of the creek where there's mosquitoes. And I'm a little concerned about, like today, I saw in the area where they're doing the road work, Daniel, they have the road blocked down to one lane, and they've been working on it. And the guys out there, I got to tell you, when I go by and look, they're doing a terrific job of making sure that silk screens up and wattles are out and very, very careful. And then I saw these guys today putting on a white suit, you know, like they were going into a hazmat zone. And I thought, what the heck's going on? So I pulled over and asked them, hey, what, somebody spill something here or something going on? Oh, no, we're going to go down and test the water in the creek. And I said, oh, really? I said, how about going down to Center Street and testing the water down there where all the homeless people are living under the bridge? And, you know, I can't imagine the additional funds that you had to spend in the county, which are our tax dollars, to make sure that somebody came out and tested the water where these guys were working to make sure they didn't drown in the creek, which is, I can tell you that it was amazing how clean they worked. And yet how hypocritical it is when people talk about cleaning the creek and we go down and there's homeless people living on the creek banks all along there and we don't do anything about it. I mean, it just to me is, it doesn't make any sense. So I would be very concerned about remapping only because some of these areas that do have some thermal streams might go away, period, because with this drought, we don't have any water. And setbacks. You want to talk about setbacks for houses? Let's still talk about setbacks for highways. Let's close some of the roads that run along the creeks and see how people like traveling along a creek. And they can't go, they have to go down the freeway. Crow Canyon would be a perfect road to close because I guarantee you part of the road has fallen into the creek. So let's just close it. It's 50 feet from the bank, 20 feet from the bank, Daniel. And we'll see how well that is accepted within the community. I'm getting a little frustrated with some of these creek ordinance guidelines, although I think you've done a good job of bringing back what was established earlier on. So thank you for the work you've done.
Thank you, Chuck. Vice Chair Carboni, what you got? You're muted, Ken.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you, Daniel, for your presentation. And but I do have some questions, and there was a lot of information there. And so I was involved years ago with the Boundary Creek and again, it's some of that stuff that Matt was saying, the original, all the original creek ordinances and mapping. But the information is probably there, but I need to get a couple of things answered. And the one thing where you were showing the creek setbacks, at the time when I was involved in this, the big debate was over, you know, a concrete culvert and how the creeks affected the urban areas versus the rural areas. Now, there's a lot here to digest, and it's hard to determine how some of these changes are going to affect some of these areas. So my question is, example is, I'm calling it Madison Creek, but there's a creek over here, you know, on Madison Road, right? What is the definition of that? Is that a stream? Is that a culvert? What actually is it? I mean, to the county, what do you call it?
So you want me to answer right now?
I just want some clarification here because I just got to understand what the difference is here on, like, say, Madison Creek, right? Or I'm calling it a creek, but, you know, it's got a concrete culvert in it. So what is it exactly?
Well, you know, basically a conveyance system. Right now we're trying to limit it to the creeks, the natural creeks.
And
the flood control channels also, because you know, historically, right now will be very difficult, but historically we know the flood control concreted these channels so that they have the banks that are armored,
right?
And there's no washout and all that stuff. So those are considered also water courses. So the distinction I think you're trying to probably look for is, you know, natural versus man-made type of conveyance systems. So we are calling them the same way. But one of the things that we have done this time is, you know, there are some areas where you have, if you consider every underground system a water course, basically every roadway that has a curb and gutter has an underground culvert that carries drainage water.
Right.
Those are not considered to be water courses. So what we consider water courses is a natural creek. And then if it comes to a point where it goes underground because of some past improvement or something, that continues as a water course, even though it's channeled or concreted or culverted within the line of that natural creek.
So in the urban area, say through, like, example, like in the Baywood area down off of Redwood Road, the housing tract goes all around the concrete culvert that's there or stream. How does these setbacks affect those properties. And the way it looks to me is that you couldn't build those houses if in fact that has to follow the same rule. How is that true? Or I mean, I just want to get this stuff cleared up because it's just bothering me how this, you know, we've been taking away, you know, property rights one inch at a time. And does it affect this or not?
I don't know the exact development, but one of the things that is debatable, of course, as you can hear, different opinions are out there. But from our point of view, one of the purpose of the water course is to make sure there's no erosion of banks and washout of, you know, silt and stuff like that. When you concrete a wall, when you concrete a channel, you could basically make it vertical. Vertical wall can be built in like San Lorenzo Creek, in some part of San Lorenzo Creek is a vertical wall that carries a lot of water at a high speed. So for me, the top of bank is the top of that concrete wall. So you have to be 20 feet away from there. Now, some people will argue, well, you know, because you concreted it, you need to actually go from the bottom and to the one and extend it out, which probably will get to your concern about property rights. Because if we were to do that along, for example, every property along San Lorenzo where it's concreted, you'll wipe out all the houses. You will need the houses right. to become
well, part that, of. So, I mean, that's my point. And yeah. So I know that we're kind of, you know, establishing some things here. And I just wanted to make sure that those were done. And then also too, in the urban area, Castro Valley chose to, you know, protect our canyon lands and, you know, develop heavily on kind of the, you know, on our higher density urban areas and to continue with that. And so I just was wondering, so those concrete culverts that are in here are quasi streams in a way, I guess.
Yeah.
They still have to be, there's a setback to them, but it's not as impactful as it is in a more rural area is what it sounds like to me. Is that true?
So the concrete channels, by the way, this ordinance does not go and investigate existing homes or anything else, whether they are. So this is for anything that has to do anybody wanting to develop or want to do some work along these creeks. And that's why
do you see that there's any conflict with the SB 365?
You know, that's one of the things I don't think I have checked. We can check unless Kathy Lee, our county council, she's on, unless she's she can opine. I'm not as familiar with 365 at this time. But let me say this so that everybody can kind of get a better framework. You know, everybody has their own opinion about these different things. The only thing that I want to say is that the water course ordinance has never been stopped from being implemented. Now, you know, people like Kelly were talking all these things that basically indicates, you know, either he likes to hear himself talking or something. I don't see anything from what he said to be factual. So what I'm telling you is the water course ordinance says streams are defined by the USGS map. Okay, we've always applied that standard. In 2021, there's a USGS map that we followed. Okay, people didn't like that. We didn't remove anything. USGS map came in. The water course ordinance references to that map. So we continue to apply the same map, just like we have always done. So the water course ordinance has always been applied. This notion that the agency abandoned all that stuff is a bunch of crap, to tell you the truth. So that's one. Number two, all the streams shown in there have been looked at for the 50 acres requirement. And, you know, the ordinance says gives the discretionary authority to the director to evaluate creeks based on the 50 acre drainage area and all that stuff. You know what? We removed that language because when we developed the map, we actually looked at the 50 acres and everything that's 50 acres and up is included in the map. There might be one or two that we missed. So there's no reason for us to be redundant in our statements. So the one reason we added also the Google map is you can click on it and see, like I showed you earlier, the name of the creek and what all those features are readily available. So you can also do that. By the way, the FAQ, the frequently asked questions, was not a requirement of the ordinance. Had I not put it in there, we would not be discussing it. But somebody put some information. All of a sudden, everybody wants to opine about it. You know what? Which is great. But the bottom line is, it was not a requirement of the upgrade for the ordinance. We are trying to be customer friendly and be responsive to the citizens so that they can actually see and learn. And then we'll continue to update this thing. So, you know, sometimes it's good to say thank you for providing this kind of information. So, you know, people like Bruce, I've been working with them, but the FAQ is not something to opine too much about. We can add or subtract things as the need arises. So, you know, we can, you know, we don't dictate, by the way, what regulatory agency should do what. You know, we don't say fish and game or this or that. So we just said people are responsible to make sure that other federal, state, local government regulations are, adhered to. So there's a lot of nitpicking here that you see, but I really appreciate the question raised about, you know, the abatement issue. Now, enforcement is, you know, we don't just go out there and, you know, here's a fine and you can go ahead and destroy the creek. No, that's why we actually wanted to go to the BZA so that when somebody violates, they don't just pay a fine. They actually have to abate. They have to correct the problem. By the way, just for your information, the WPO is not a permit to build. It's actually rarely used because it really is a prohibitive ordinance. You don't want people to come in and do stuff. So, you know, sometimes, you know, it's good to understand the intent of this thing. And I think, you know, the historical aspect, all we've done, and this is very important to understand, all we have done is the maps that we've used for 30 or 40 years are restored back to what they were. And in order to do that, to validate some of our concern, we went out and looked at randomly or method several areas to see, are these really legitimate creeks to be eliminated? And we saw some water. So, you know, if somebody wants to study the whole Alameda County creeks, you know, go at it. But, you know, it's not, you know, somebody has to raise some kind of fee or revenue to do something like that. But it's really, honestly speaking, this change is so narrow focused. The debate should be, should we stay with 2021 map or should we actually restore back to the 2015 that we've used for the last 40 years. So I cannot tell you whether something is going to be a creek or not, just based on a very cursory review. All I'm saying is that's what we've used for the last 30 years. Why not restore it back? And Chuck, you brought a question about some of those enforcement things. You're absolutely right. For a lot of people do not appreciate the cost associated with some of this regulatory framework or requirement regimes, you know, just to do when we go out there and clean a creek, literally clean a silt out of a creek that has been building up, we have to do mitigation for that temporary work. And that temporary work sometimes could cost you multi-million dollars just to mitigate, to remove the silt so that the creek can flow properly. We have to go out there. It's not optional. It's not an option that I can say, I'm not going to do this. They literally will make you do these things. So if I go out there and clean out Alameda Creek for 1 mile, I guarantee you, I need to buy some property for mitigation for $5-6 million somewhere else. So these are not cheap undertakings that we are talking about. So when you saw something tested, it is, you know, people might think, oh, public works part of the government system. No, we are regulated just about like everybody else. We have to comply with this thing. So, you know, I'll be honest with you, Bruce King has been a good partner. We've worked with him very well. I've given him feedback, advance notices of these things, and his comments are legitimate comments, some of them. If we find some creek that was not shown, but it was in the 2015 map, you know, as we speak, we are updating some of these maps. So the question is, should we stay with the 2015 map and beyond, or somebody could say, no, I'd like to stay with it. Should be the real debate right now, because the rest of the stuff we have not get into making any changes to it other than introduce a more community-oriented abatement process using the BZA. So I hope this kind of gives you the intent, because it's a real narrow-focused update.
Thank you, Daniel. Councilmember Thomas has his hand up, and then I'd like to ask a couple of questions as well. So, Joe?
Hey, Councilmember Vice Chair Ken, you have a backup question? Okay, I could wait.
No, I just wanted to thank Daniel. No, and for clearing up a couple of things for me.
Thanks, Ken.
Yep. All right. Quick question, Daniel. Thank you. Thank you for coming up here doing the presentation. Hey, enforcement. You talked about enforcement. Myself, if you come up to me and say, "Hey, Tojo, you know, you violated this ordinance, $500 fine, I'll pay it." But if you go to the creek, like Chuck talked about, you go to the creek and there's homeless population. How do you enforce this on them? You know, they're also, you know, probably polluting the creeks. How do you enforce anything on them?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a paradox. I mean, and Chuck has made a very good observation. You know, one time we went out to clear out a creek, homeless encampment along the Coliseum. I don't know if you guys are familiar. There's a creek that goes along the Coliseum. You know, you're talking about buckets and buckets of human waste being dumped in there. A lot of stuff. So, you know, that's part of the challenge of this kind of environment we're in. How do you reconcile the difference between somebody not having a home and yet polluting a creek versus the other way around? So, you know, I try to kind of stay away from those things. That's not our role to enforce, to tell you the truth, because when you say, you know, let's say, Mr. Thomas, you wanted to go ahead and build something in your backyard and there's a creek. We're gonna tell you from the top of bank, you have to actually have 20 feet before you build anything else. That's what this thing says. So, but if you go out there and did something and you never reported, you will find out. You're not gonna get away with just $400 fine. That's not a fine. We're gonna make you take out what you built, restore back the creek, and move the development back to the 20 feet. So the argument that people say, you know, somebody is spending $450,000 of damages and get away with a $400 fine. No, those two don't add up. Okay. Those not inconsistent. Those two are totally inconsistent. You will be required to restore. So the best advice is first, before you do anything, make sure you follow the ordinance. If you have any question, contact our office. We will let you know how far back. By the way, there was a discussion about the various other typical sections of the creek. The other two basically are dependent on the floodplain management. Floodplain management is a totally different ordinance. It's governed by FEMA. That's how you pay your flood insurance and all that stuff. So there's no need to incorporate those drawings into the WPO. Same thing with the building code requirement as to how high or low you build your building. So we clarified those things in this ordinance with a clear intent that we need to make it very clear to the residents and the people that actually have to follow these rules. I hope I answered your question, but you and Chuck brought up a very good question. I mean, it is very worrisome when you see buckets and buckets of human waste being dumped into a creek, and some of our regulatory folks go out there and try to test an area that has none of that problem.
And that's the difference comes up. You know, we care about our community. We want our community and our creeks, you know, done right. But when you look at the human waste and all that stuff, you know, there's a few folks who don't care about the, you know, area. So I don't know how you, I know you answered it right. I don't know how you make that. That's not your job either. So, you know, we just have to. I hear you. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Tojo. Daniel, a couple. Well, first on the enforcement issue. I totally understand that abatement is likely to be the higher cost and the disincentive. Truly, though, it's best for the community, for the environment, if a potential need for abatement doesn't get started to begin with. And I know you feel that way. My belief is if $500 got people's attention, nobody would speed on Crow Canyon Road because that's about the price of a ticket. I'd love to see that as a disincentive to do something that could be a potential future abatement. So, you know, in my humble opinion, $500 doesn't get close. That's a Visa card, buy, you know, catch you next time. So I'd love to see the enforcement punched up a little bit. Regarding what Councilmember Carboni brought up, SB 365, you know, we can't enact ordinances that make it more restrictive to engage in building. And I heard you use the phrase, the maps could be restored back to what they were. And I'm not sufficiently qualified to provide an answer to that, but I strongly hope that there will be an analysis done and a look at whether, you know, which way we go, going back to the 2015 maps, you know, how each alternative stacks up against SB 365, and perhaps Ms. Lee has some, as you said, you know, has some information for us, but that that's really dangerous to, you know, get sideways with that. And then last question, what's the process? I mean, hypothetically, someone could stumble across a water course, a creek, a stream that, you know, is not on the current map, whatever form that takes. What's the process for getting a new water course added to the eventual map?
Sure, that's great. So just to kind of make everybody at ease, this is informational, as you can see, so that we can hear what everybody is saying. We want to hear what you're saying. So there's not a decision point at this time. Enforcement-wise, Bill, those dollar values that you see are generally, basically, it's a cost recovery number, because these things have to be enforced. This has to be reviewed. Somebody has to go out there and investigate a violation and all those things. So somebody has to pay for that. So those are the dollars that you see are generally speaking, for that purposes. The best thing that we can do is educate people as to the value of creeks, and not violating, you know, and destroying them does not add value as a society in general. However, if someone intentionally violates the ordinance, then we're going to have to, you know, do the abatement, and the abatement needs to be enforced. That's where I see a lot of the challenges, because you go out there and tell somebody, you need to remove this $450,000 home that you illegally built in the water course, you know it's going to be a very highly debated scenario. So somewhere along the line, the BZA and the Board of Supervisors will have to say, you know, are we willing to take that kind of push? That's one. So I appreciate your comment in that sense. But the dollars that you see in terms of the cost is really more of a cost recovery mechanism. In terms of identifying a new creek, a new water course, or if you think this water course does not belong, it's not a water course, you need to take it out. There's a modification process identified in the ordinance. And it was very clearly stated. And I think you have a copy of the ordinance. So that process basically puts some degree of the burden on the individual who either wants to add or take out the creek from the system by technically showing that and making their case, and it comes to our office and we will evaluate that and make the appropriate recommendation. So the 50 acres drainage area was initially implemented in the previous one, but you know, that's a fairly random number. I think it's more restrictive than anything else in either side. So I would recommend that the current modification process as written will be the best way to kind of add or take out a water course that exists. So I think I've answered your question, Bill, unless I missed something.
No, we're good on that. We'll have to agree to keep talking about the penalties, though.
Yeah, we will. I mean, hey, I'll be more than happy to raise them up, but you know, those things will bring in equity issues and various other issues. So at the end of the day, if there's a desire to make those penalties high, we can always explore them. We can always explore them. As you say, I don't know how high you can go. It depends. It depends how those things are determined. But we can always explore. But once again, I think the notion of SB 365 is something we're going to look at. I don't recall discussing it with Kathy, so I don't want to put Kathy on the spot at this time to know about SB 65. We can actually look at it. But from my point of view, just hypothetically, think of it this way. If USGS tomorrow comes up and say, here's modification 2022 and restore it back to 2015, we would not have any discussion. It would be just the ordinance doesn't change. The ordinance says the most current USGS map. So if they come back tomorrow and said, all right, let's go bring back the 2015 map, we will continue to reinforce it just like we're doing right now with the 2021. So the significance of the map is really a matter of saying with there a certain desire to really look at the maps that we've used for the last 30 and 40 years and basically continue with that operation. So, but I do appreciate your comment there.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple more council members who wish to speak, so we'll go back to Council Member Moore. And thank you, Daniel.
Yeah, yes, sir.
Thank you, Daniel. I just wanted to clarify a couple of things. One, you know, if we had, like the picture showed, Steelhead and the creek coming up to Crow Canyon, I would absolutely love it. I would have to go to Idaho fishing. I would jump out there with my fishing pole and hang out in the creek. But reality is, when you start looking at these creeks right now, because of the droughts that we've had, it's a sad situation. There is not much water or any water at all in some of them. And my concern is you start remapping and you may take some of these off of the map and it may come back as a creek one day. So, you know, I like what you've done from that standpoint, Daniel. And it would concern me when we start pulling blue lines or lines off the creek or off the map without a lot of data behind it. And, you know, once again, I don't think the county gets enough credit with the folks about creeks when they look at some of the work that's being done along Crow Canyon Road. This road was falling into the creek. I mean, sliding down the mountain. And I don't know how much money we spent. It had to be millions of dollars out there shoring it up. And, you know, it's frustrating when you see the effort that's being put forward. And I hike down a creek picking up tires and rims on a regular basis because things fly out of people's cars and end up down there. And occasionally a car ends up in there. But at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot more to do with the people that live under the underpasses and the pollution that we're creating in these creeks, and we're just not addressing it. And it's really frustrating, and I don't know where do you start and who's the responsible party, but it has to be done. Thanks, Bill, for the opportunity to speak again.
You bet, Chuck. Council Vice Chair Carbone, what you got?
All right, Daniel, I'll keep this one short. I just came up with a detail. So you got map A that we're following at present. We're going to go back to map B. Now something has happened on one of those newly identified creeks. Is that now a grandfathered project? Is that now an illegal project? How will you handle this in this case?
So what you say, so you have a new creek that's identified. Once the creek is identified as a creek and incorporated in the map, then the entire ordinance applies for any new development.
But not a new development, but an existing. Say that between the two maps.
Huh? Yeah, existing, I'll let Kathy respond. But from my understanding, once, if there's a creek right now, it has not been identified on the map, and somebody is building something, they don't have to comply with the WPO. And a year later, we said, oh, by the way, that's a creek. We're not going to tell them to move their stuff. There's no such requirement that I'm aware of. Kathy, I'll let you speak.
Thank you, Daniel. That's correct, Council Member Carbone. The ordinance was designed originally to be expressly not retroactive. And the if at the time that you pulled your entitlements and permits, you were not a mapped water course, then you are allowed to proceed as long as you actually pulled your permits and were in compliance at the time. We do not go back and retroactively pull existing development that was compliant at the time of the entitlements into the ordinance. And to speak a little bit to the concern about whether or not this is potentially some kind of discretionary restriction that we might have some concern about in terms of some of the recent housing acts, this is not designed to be a condition as part of a discretionary conditional use permit or one of those types of entitlements. In fact, some of the discretionary decision-making we removed and in favor of just having a standard map that people can look at and hopefully comply with and not be an enforcement matter to begin with. And the idea is to have setbacks that are set forth to be consistent with past practice. As Director Woldesenbett pointed out, you know, the idea is not that from the time of the 2015 map one day to the next day, when, you know, the 2018 map was adopted, that these geological features, these water courses disappeared. That's not really consistent with what we believe our mandate is in terms of the, you know, at least staff believes the mandate is in terms of the water course protection ordinance. And in terms of that mapping, just to speak to the, you know, the specific discussion about the drought concern, the USGS maps are not typically used for example, establishing federal jurisdiction. They are studies that USGS typically undertakes. They're not on the ground field, data-driven. You know, they're not sending out people to take pictures of all of these creeks and to do a study, in-depth study of whether or not there is in fact water there running at any particular time. And you know, certainly there are technicians who have a better understanding of how they do their mapping, but I believe it is frequently using aerial photography of vegetation. So the notion that USGS maps simply by virtue of being what's in the existing ordinance are somehow are more data rich, I don't know that that is actually anything that the USGS represents or would say even about their own maps. Even for, you know, some, as many have mentioned, there are many layers of regulatory jurisdiction over water. We are merely one of them. But some of the notions of intermittent, perennial, ephemeral, those do come up with respect to Clean Water Act jurisdiction. And specifically to the drought comments, typically the way that they look at whether or not a water course is, or a particular stream is ephemeral or intermittent or perennial, is to look at the typical year. So the typical rainy season, when looking at the seasonality of an intermittent stream, would not be, for example, a historic drought year. It would be the typical rainy season. I forget the time scales they look at, but they have a particular time scale that they look at to determine what is the typical rainy season that we would determine whether or not a water course runs seasonally. And that's another challenge to sort of taking a very isolated snapshot where, you know, if you're having a particularly dry year, as others have pointed out, you may not see water in a water course. But at least at the federal level, they do take a sort of wider lens. And the idea is to try and determine whether or not water would flow in a particular direction in a typical rainy season year.
Thank you.
Daniel, one quick question. Where do you go from here? Where does the water course update go in terms of public hearings and bodies?
Well, I was hoping that this is such a narrow change in the water course, really a map adaption, basically, that after hearing from you guys, I could go and bring it to the TMP, or somebody suggested maybe bringing it to the Planning Commission. I didn't think it could rise to that level, but since you guys mentioned SB 365, maybe that's one of the things I might do, is take it to the Planning Commission and have that concern vetted. But primarily then from here, I was going to go to the Fairview MAC and present it to the MAC. Then, so ideally, I was going to go MAC, the two MACs, and then to the Transportation Planning Committee, and then to the board. But we might add Planning Commission onto this thing. So I really appreciate the feedback, and I do appreciate your frustrations as you expressed them. And you know, Steelheads, Chuck did not know this, but we invested collectively recently over almost $30 million on a fish passage project on Alameda Creek. You might want to go see them. That's a massive structure that allows, there's a fish ladder, actually allows hopefully the steelhead to go on its way on a spawning area. And it's an investment. That's another, like I said, $30 million. And the previous one prior to that was another $30 million. So within a very narrow range, there has been nearly $60 million to restore back the steelhead. So there is a great deal of commitment by the community and everybody to protect our creeks and restore them back. And people like Bruce King were instrumental, and the Friends of the Creeks out there, the fisheries group up in Alameda Creek, very instrumental. So I do believe creeks have enormous social value. I think we need to protect them. I think we need to do anything we can to make sure to avoid any unnecessary, discourse. I would say really looking at, these were the creeks that we all agreed on for the last 30 years and 40 years. Why all of a sudden not go back to those? I don't know. So, but we'll hear about the SB 365 from a discussion, and we'll look at it ourselves to see if there is any legal restrictions with the going back to the 2015 maps. So hopefully that answers most of the questions that everybody has. Some of them are very hard questions, like Tojo's and Chuck's. I don't know how you handle homeless people, but if you can help us with the regulatory folks save some costs, that would even be greater. By the way, Chuck, that project that you just mentioned where you saw testing, the design, the engineering part took very, fast decision. The regulatory permitting part took forever. It cost a lot of money. And just to restore back, imagine to restore, to put the road back from falling into the creek, we have to pay premium, real premium. So I sometimes kind of disagree with our regulatory folks because, they're sitting in Sacramento and Washington, D.C. telling us how to take care of our own creeks and at some premium price. So I think we have a lot more self-interest to protect our own creeks through these kind of regulations. And I do appreciate the feedback from folks like yourself that clearly want to balance the value add by creeks as well as not harm private property rights. So it's great. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Daniel. And thank you, Ms. Lee, for being here. And I especially want to thank all the members of the community who came out and spoke with passion, genuine care and concern for the community, for the righteousness and for the environment. Makes me proud to be a Castro Valley. And so thank you all. We are now at agenda item 8, Councilor Chair's report and comments. I have no report, but I do have a quick question, and I'm sorry to ask this, but there's different versions floating around. Anyone who will not be in attendance at next Monday's land use meeting, please raise your hand. Very good. Okay. Thank you all, and again, apologize for the 19th request there. Do we have any council comments or questions? Anybody from staff wish to provide anything for the good of the order?
Nothing for me. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I just wish everybody a blessed and warm Thanksgiving.
Have a great Thanksgiving.
Hope there's gratitude and abundance. And we'll see you all next Monday for the land use meeting.
All right. Take care.
Good night.
Cheers. Thank you all.